Hey, Closet Busters, come on and gather around. It's time once again to kick down those closet doors of life. We're here to escape our BS, explore our fears, and elevate our self-expression. I'm your host, Rick Clemens, bold move expert and coming out coach, and I'm going to take you to the party, the pulpit, the wake, and back to the party of living your life uncloseted. So come on, grab hold of yourself and get ready to step out, step up, and step in to living your truth as we explore more stories, tips, and tricks for living your life uncloseted. Now let's get to the show. Hey there, Closet Busters and Bold Move Makers. I'm Rick Clemens, the host of Life Uncloseted, and this is where we say, screw it, I am going to kick down those closet doors of my life. I'm going to set myself free, and I'm going to live my life uncloseted without any apologies. And I know that for many of us, sometimes living our life uncloseted means that we felt like we're flawed or we're broken, and we try to make the best sense of our life. And it's not surprising that sometimes as we're going through that, we just feel like, man, our life is on fire. It doesn't really matter whether you're struggling with maybe your sexuality or job troubles or death or obsessions about things, maybe some religious strife in your life, even trying to find acceptance for yourself. Whatever the life challenges are, the truth is, hey, you're human. And life can sometimes really truly feel like you're just in a series of putting out fires. Well, today, my guest is really captured the essence of storytelling. And he's been through a lot of fires in his life. His stories talk about living life from Los Angeles to Quebec and from Tokyo to Jerusalem. His name is Orlando Ortega. His book is Jerusalem Ablaze, Stories of Love and Other Obsessions. And I'm just really excited because I know today he's really going to take us on a little bit of a journey, or maybe a big bit of a journey, about the things he's done, the paths he's chosen, the things he's doing as an author, really showcasing some of his own living life uncloseted. So welcome to the podcast, Orlando Ortega.
Thank you very much, Rick. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I'm really excited to have you here, man. And as we chatted a few weeks ago before we had you here on the show, you're right in the midst of your book launching, and it's a fictional book. I'm going to let you just tell us a little bit about Jerusalem Ablaze.
So Jerusalem Ablaze is a collection of 13 short stories that span a number of years and take place in or are set in places that I've lived in or that have been formative in my life.
Right.
Places where I've experienced and where I've observed people in all kinds of interesting interpersonal situations, struggling with identity, struggling with relationships, their sexuality, the religious background. So I've encapsulated that journey that I've had over the past few years and set in those countries. And the result of that is Jerusalem Ablaze.
Mm-hmm. And what I loved about bringing you forward is there's so many interesting twists and turns in these stories, and there's some darkness and some humor and some vulnerabilities that show up. And it's really about the human experience, which in essence is about living your life uncloseted. It's like we all come out of these different various closets. So let's kind of step back a little bit before the book and into some of your own personal life. You actually left the U.S. not too long ago because of some things going on with the whole marriage equality and thing like that, which in its own way was your way of saying, I'm not going to stay in this closet. So kind of take us, why don't we start there, and then we'll talk a little bit about, you know, your life growing up and things like that. But what was the big impetus about, if I can't be here in the U.S. and be with that person, what really made you finally say, I'm out of here?
I met my partner in 1991, and we were really doing our best to live our lives as a couple as well as possible. If we would have been able to marry, we would have married. But, you know, we kept running into different sorts of roadblocks and situations where people didn't, either family members or friends or colleagues weren't fully recognizing our relationship the way that we wanted them to, which was the same way that they would recognize any other heterosexual married couple. You know, obviously we weren't married, we weren't able to be married, but we wanted to be accepted that way. And on a couple of trips we took to Canada, we found that we were accepted for who and what we are, no questions asked. And it was such a good feeling that we decided that, you know, rather than just continue to put up with a situation that seemed like it was never going to change in the States, which, you know, thank God it finally did,
Right.
But we just decided, just one out of a lifestyle choice, another out of kind of a protest against what we'd been going through, we decided just to emigrate to Canada, leave the United States. That was in 1999. And that's it. We've never gone back. I mean, we've gone back to visit, obviously.
Sure, sure,
but,
sure.
We've gone back to live.
Right, right. But, you know, when you talk about being back in 1991 and this all unfolding, I mean, it was definitely a different time and place in the United States and gay rights and everything, really, for couples of same sex. And then if you bring in, you know, couples who were maybe interracial couples or intercultural couples, you know, coming into the U.S. and stuff, it was just such a nightmare because there was no real true recognition. So as you made the move and you left in 1999, what was really the first thing you really felt once you landed in Canada? I mean, what was the thing that you know, you observed it up there, but what did you really feel once you were there and living your lives as a couple?
We observed that our relationship was not an issue in any way, shape, or form, that we were accepted as a couple just exactly the way any other heterosexual couple was accepted, which was amazing. And this was both in the workplace, in the community that we lived in. Just, it was, I mean, I'm sure there must be somewhere out in Canadian society, you know, some discrimination, but we didn't experience, we experienced the complete opposite. And it was a feeling as if a burden had been completely lifted off our shoulders. And it was the first time, I think, that we really felt that we had the commitment to each other as a couple. But I think the fact that part of that experience as a couple was in struggling to be seen as a couple, I think since once that was removed, then it was a whole, it was almost like as if our relationship went into a higher plane at that point, because we no longer had to be struggling about that. And you know, it's interesting because in the States, before we moved to Canada, we had relocated from Los Angeles to San Francisco. And San Francisco was something similar to, I'd say, what we experienced in Canada. But San Francisco was really more of a bubble within a sea of intolerance, I would say. So,
well, I think that's a really great observation, because, you know, people will sometimes say, oh, things are better now. And I'm like, well, not really. It depends on where you're at. You know, it's, you know, if you're in a San Francisco or you're in a West Hollywood or a Miami or, you know, Fort Lauderdale and New York, and so I find it really interesting that, you know, people say things like, oh, in that bubble, you know, and yet it is a bubble, because no matter where you are in the U.S., there's still lots of struggles. And not just the U.S., there's plenty of struggles across the globe. But things have changed, but in so many ways, they still haven't changed enough, because there's many people out in the middle states that still don't feel comfortable being who they are, living their lives the way they are, married or unmarried. And this just continues to be the closet that so many people find themselves stuck in, even though marriage equality, you know, knock on wood right now, is still part of the fabric of our lives. So let's kind of step back to, you know, you've had a lot of, you know, different changes and stuff throughout your life. And one of the things I found really fascinating about, you know, your background and everything is you've, you know, lived many different places throughout your life, but even your family life was kind of a mixed bag of tricks. So you're Jewish, correct?
Yes, that's right.
And you were also of Cuban descent. So kind of take us into all these different mixes and things in your life as a person, because even that is like an interesting conglomerate of unusual closets that suddenly this is what makes Orlando, Orlando, so to speak.
Right. Yeah. Well, as far as my Jewish background, so these days, Jews tend to descend from two sort of major cultural streams. One is known as Ashkenazi, which originating in more modern times in Eastern Europe and Germany, going back. And then another group that originates from Spain, known as Sephardi Jews. So my family were Sephardi Jews who emigrated to Cuba, say in the 1800s, late 1900s. And that's where my parents were born. And then during the Cuban Revolution, they left Cuba and emigrated to the States. And obviously, we know that in the States, most Jews are of the Eastern European descent.
Right.
And so my experience was, it was very interesting growing up because I was a child of Hispanics. So they were from Cuba. We spoke Spanish in the home, but we didn't quite fit in with the Cuban community, which was mainly Roman Catholic. We didn't exactly fit in well with the Jewish community because they were mainly Ashkenazi and the customs were quite different from what my family was used to. So, and then my parents had this idea when we were growing up about the possibility of returning to Cuba at some point once the revolution died down and things became more favorable for return. So in a sense, I as an individual had a difficult time in my early years to really understand who and what I was in the face of all of these differences. For example, the neighborhood that I grew up in primarily were white Anglo-Saxon Protestant neighbors who were all very nice, but they saw us as something very different. And I was different to all of my friends and schoolmates. So I was always having to carve out or to try to define who and what I was outside of the home, as well as inside of the home. So that was quite a challenge. And then as I grew older and realized that I was also different in terms of my sexuality, that was another struggle to try to find my identity. Who was I in terms of that? So all of those things, I internalized, I think, up until I started writing. And that was once I was a sophomore in high school, and I started pouring out a lot of these struggles onto the page and writing stories. So I externalized my struggles in fiction. And also I, at one period in my life, was writing music as well. So I used to create both music and prose as a form of, I don't know, self-discovery, therapy, whatever it is you want to call it.
So I'm curious, through all of that, because, you know, now here we are many years down the road, what did that struggle through trying to find yourself and your space, how did that enhance your life today? Because I know how, I know for me, all the struggles have given me some really strong capabilities to just stay focused, to do the thing I know I'm meant to do, to, for the most part, not let things get deeply under my skin. But I'm curious for you, as you went through all those different changes, especially, you know, you, as you just described, you know, trying to find your place in your own religion, and then, you know, your homosexuality shows up, and then how has that helped you now later in life?
I think that one of the things I needed to learn early on was how to be honest with myself and the people that I was around, because I had so many, I could dip in and out of so many different identities. Let's put it, let's call it that. I had a trunk full of identities, the Hispanic identity, the Jewish identity, the gay identity, the the musician, the writer, the, you know, I had so many things that, so many costumes I could wear, as you say. But I had to learn really like which was me. And I had to be honest with myself to find out who that was, and then to be able to communicate that to the outside world. So I think that that process of not hiding, but actually being fully sort of out there with people, helped me to become a stronger, more confident person. So that's one way that I'd say that the experience helped me. Also, the fact that I did come from a multi-ethnic, multi-religious, I suppose you could say, background, all of my experiences collected, has also helped me to understand many different types of people who are maybe less exotic than I am, but I, because I'm able to empathize with people who come from many different walks of life, because in a sense, I have a bit of all of that in myself.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, it's interesting that you brought up the honesty piece. I just did a podcast in the last few days, actually, where I brought up the question, what's scarier, to be honest or to be dishonest? And it ruffled a few feathers because I had a few people already send me some emails about why would it be scary to be honest? And I'm like, think about it, you know, to stand. And I think as you were speaking, I got just kind of envisioning in my mind that that honesty you had to come to with yourself can be really scary. It's like, okay, this is honestly who I am. And I love the metaphor you use of the costumes. You know, which costume am I going to put on? Because each and every day, I think we all put on costumes. But the real question becomes, is this costume honestly who I am? Or is it something just to help me get by, get through the day, to be in the moment, with the people I need to be with. And so that begs the question, is it scarier for us as humans to be honest, or is it scarier to be dishonest? And I can argue both sides of the fence, but I'm curious, since I know you've also got that beautiful law degree behind us, what's your take on what I just brought up about, is it scarier to be honest or scarier to be dishonest?
Well, for me, it's scarier these days. I would say I've learned that more scary to be dishonest. Mm-hmm. Because at the end of the day, and I'll qualify that in a second, but at the end of the day, people are smart. People mm-hmm. can tell when you're being cagey, when you're mm-hmm. not quite being straight with them. So, excuse the pun, but yeah, so I would say that in that sense, it would be difficult to live with myself and to sleep well at night if I knew mm-hmm. that I'd been out there in the world withholding who I am from the world, because at the end of the day, they'll know who I am somehow. Mm-hmm. So being as transparent as possible, I would say is more comfortable for me. It may not be for everybody else,
sure,
but I mean, it's still, even in terms of the stories that I write, I find that I'm probably very painfully honest in some of the stories. And it does scare some people actually mm-hmm. thinking, you know, how could you have put your mind into the place of writing this story or that story, or how could you imagine this or that? Mm-hmm. And the truth is that, so I take a bit of flack, say, from being so honest, but then again, I'm only outing myself, so to speak, not anybody
right.
else.
Right. So in that honesty and that transparency that shows up in the stories, how often do people come to you and go, did you really do that? Was that you, or was that just a figment of your imagination? Do you get that a lot?
Yeah, I get that all the time.
I'm sure you do. So for the listeners who haven't read the book, give us like an example of something that would be really one of those things somebody might go, is that really you? Give us just a quick snippet without giving away the whole, you know, a whole story, but what's a good example of that?
Let me think about that, because, you know, the stories, I think like all fiction, have something of the author in it and something of their mm-hmm. imagination as well. So I think that there are probably aspects. Well, for another interview I did, I once said that I'm every character in the book. I'm the men, the women, the young, the old, the mm-hmm. the priest, the prostitute. I'm every character in the book. It has something of me in it. So in that sense, I would say that what's on the page came out from inside of me, and mm-hmm. then I reworked it with my imagination in order to create the stories. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, I would say that none of the stories are biographical or autobiographical, right. but all of the stories have something in them of things that I've either experienced or observed.
Okay.
So, for example, there's one story in there about a young literature student from UCLA, which is where I went to school and what I studied, who has an encounter with a famous author who's already in his twilight years and is soon going to die. And it's about a sexual encounter between the two of them, where the young literature student is trying to get some sort of feedback or endorsement for his writing from this older writer. Mm-hmm. So that was one that people immediately came to me and said, well, hang on a second, this must be you mm-hmm. because you went to that school, you lived in that area, you studied
right.
that. So did this happen?
Right.
And the answer is no, that didn't happen. But
it's so fascinating how people make the assumptions. You know, they immediately mm-hmm. jump to, and it's so interesting to me, because I know I do it, but it's so interesting to me that it's really a reflection of what they'd really like to see it happen. You know, they really want that, because then there's something they can latch on to. Yet if it did happen, then you almost get curious to what does that mean about them? If they are so adamant about you actually having done that, what is that reflecting in them about who they are and what they may desire? I always find that people who get really wrapped up in fiction, I'm a huge crime fiction person, there's always a piece of me that's like, yeah, I'd really like to be some of those characters in that book because I'm fascinated by this. But it always, to me, reflects that whatever somebody else has seen in a piece of fiction is also reflecting something in themselves they'd actually probably like to be acting on.
Hmm. Yeah, I think that's right.
So with Jerusalem Ablaze, you know, you pulled together these beautiful, fascinating, sometimes dark and, you know, funny and scary stories, so to speak, in different ways. What has it done for you to be able to finally see that come to life and really put it out there in the way that you've done it?
I've really been quite surprised at the positive reception it's received, especially from professional reviewers. Mm-hmm. I was expecting it to have mixed reviews just simply because of the fact that some of the material is quite daring, and you know, some of it gets very close to being over the top in parts. But it's been positively received that way, and it's so in that sense, I think it's given me more confidence as a writer, and as a result of how it's been received. And also, it was shortlisted for a major literary prize in the UK called the Polari First Book Prize. My output since having written the book has increased exponentially, and so I'm writing a lot more. I think that my technique as a writer has gotten much better, and I'm looking forward to the next projects that I'm working on, to seeing them in print.
So I'm always curious, and this is one of those trite, you know, interview questions, but I'm always curious about this. What did you discover most about yourself as you went through this first book process?
Good question. What did I discover most about myself?
You know, because here's the thing. I know for me, when I went through my book, what I discovered most about myself was I've always been a very transparent guy. But there were moments in the middle of the book as I started going through the editing process, and then especially once I started recording the audiobook, where I discovered I actually got a little bit scared about being so transparent. But in that fear, I also gained the courage that being transparent is what really truly enabled me to be even more who I wanted to be. It wasn't because I wanted to tell these stories of truth about myself, like, oh, look what I did. But it's almost like I had to go through this process of, okay, you've been really transparent, Rick, and you really have told these stories, and now you've given pieces of yourself. And I had to get scared to realize, okay, I can keep going. I can actually keep going and doing the work I'm doing, because if I can be that transparent, what I'm sharing is how transparency can actually lead you to a life that enabled you to constantly be who you are. But I had to go through a couple of really scary moments. I remember at one point, so I was actually recording my audiobook in my closet, literally, because the sound quality was so much better, literally, in my walk-in closet. I remember at one point reading a couple of lines in the book, and I stopped, and I was so overwhelmed with tears that I just wanted to pick up the phone and call my publisher and say, we can't do this. But it was too late. The book was already published. The book was already in print. And it was in the audio midst. And so what I found was that the transparency is something I've always been good at. But I had to go through a scary piece of realizing how much my transparency put me in a different frame in people's eyes. But it also empowered me to keep going and continuing to teach how beautiful transparency and boldness are. And now, of course, my brand being, you know, Make Your Bold Move, transparency is something that helps you make your bold moves. So now we can come back to you. I've given you a little bit of food for thought there, but what's something you did learn about yourself?
I think it's that I wasn't, even though I'd been writing for quite a long time and had a lot of material, I think that I learned that I probably didn't push enough to try to get my material published previously, because I was surprised to find out that I wasn't really ready, maybe mm-hmm. psychologically ready, to have this material out there in the public until it came out. So it's mm-hmm. it's almost, I suppose, the realization that I wasn't ready to be that transparent mm-hmm. as you're talking mm-hmm. about. Mm-hmm. I mean, even when it came to just the book was being typeset and I hadn't shown it to my parents yet, and I did because I said, you know, I don't want the book to come out with them having known that I had, you know, sold the book, and that right. I wanted them to be aware of it beforehand. So they looked at it, and I had some very, very, very difficult feedback from my father with regards to a couple of the stories in the book. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I realized that probably would have been much worse earlier, but, you know, they'd come to terms as well with who I was and by that point, but still there were some things that they struggled with. But I realized that I was ready. Mm-hmm. And so I wasn't going to let that stop me from going forward on the publication of the book. And I'm very happy that I did.
You know, I love that you just used the phrase, I was ready, because I think it's one of the pivotal moments. Those of us who come out of the closet know that when you finally can say, I'm ready, then that's actually when you actually come out. You know when you're ready. As a basis for this podcast in general of Life Uncloseted, one of the key principles I try to teach people as I'm taking them through their coaching or, you know, speaking from stages or using this podcast as a medium is one of the most pivotal moments in any coming out journey, whether it's coming out of a job you hate or taking that leap of faith to go ahead and go into a relationship that everybody else says, no, that's not a good one for you, or, you know, writing your first book, is when you actually can say the words, I'm ready. That's your go button. That's when it's time. Until you're ready to say those words, it's probably not going to happen. And anybody who tries to push you before you're ready to say those words, this is why, you know, in our world of LGBTQ coming out stories, I love everybody's love and compassion for somebody that they go, oh yeah, I know my friend's gay, I just wish they would just come out, what can I do to help them? And I always say, give them the space to say, I'm ready. It's not up to you to say, you're ready, now do this. It's, you know, giving someone the space. And it's interesting, as I've worked in some organizations and spoke on a couple of stages in some non-LGBT related environment, when I get to that point of the interesting space of knowing when you're ready to uncloset yourself from a situation is when you actually can say the words, I'm ready. You can almost hear a collective aha in the audience if people really get that. So kind of glad you brought that up, because I didn't think that's where we might go in this interview. But to talk a little bit about your next project, what comes after Jerusalem of Light? Any ideas, or is it just in like, I'm just writing and we'll see what comes from it?
So I finished recently a novel that is my editor now, and it's a really long novel about two kids who are the product of immigration, one whose parents emigrated to the States from Japan, and the other one who emigrated from Israel as a young boy, and the adventure that they have when they meet each other. So it seems that the feedback I'm getting on it is that it may actually end up being two books instead of one. It may actually be one that focuses on one character and one that focuses on the other, rather than one with the two of them. But in any case, that's being worked out at the moment. That's what's next on the burner.
Awesome. And it sounds like it's just staying with your theme of continuing to draw upon your own life experiences and bringing in the imagination that then comes from, you know, whatever you've had in the past from your own life. So that's really exciting on that note. So if you could like guide someone or leave someone with some advice on what it really means, because, you know, you've gone through leaving the States and then now you live in London and, you know, stuff you've gone through with your partner and husband and all the childhood background, you've been through a lot of uncloseting your life and opening yourself up to new things. If you could leave some piece of advice to someone who's like, I just don't know if I can do this, I can't make this kind of bold move, or I can't see my path clearly to go release myself into something, what would you encourage someone to do?
I'd say do a lot of look at yourself, but really, really look at yourself when you're struggling with these questions. And because I really do believe that the answer to a lot of our questions, our struggles, and are buried deep inside of ourselves. And it's a matter of having a deep, honest conversation with yourself first before speaking to someone else, that where you'll start to find the answer in terms of what you should do. Now, you know, for me, the answer was leaving, but I don't think that that's necessarily the answer for everybody. But in my case, it was. And how did I know that? It's because, you know, I dug really deep. I had conversations with myself first. I worked out these things on my own. And then, you know, I sought some guidance from other people. But I think that a lot of people, and again, this is just my view, but I think a lot of people seek guidance too soon, actually.
Yeah, I
think that some people, I think they need to first get to know themselves and try to figure themselves out before then seeking guidance. Because if you seek guidance too soon, I think that what ends up happening is that you just let somebody else dictate what it is that you should or shouldn't do. So that's what I would say is my two cents worth.
You and I must be in the same wavelength, because if you were speaking, I'm like, I'm going to just follow up what he's saying with, I think people seek guidance too soon. And there you went. You said it, but I agree 100%, because we become conditioned as humans that, okay, well, let me go ask somebody. When reality, before you say, let me go ask somebody, why don't you find the answer within? Do everything you can to find the answer within first, because if you go get the answer from somebody else, then there's a high likelihood that you're just doing what somebody else recommends. Now, there's not anything wrong with doing that. There's great reasons to have a mentor and a guidance and stuff like that. But for me, when I'm working with someone, they say, what would you do? I always say, you know, I'm glad you asked that question, because I'm going to share what I would do. But I don't want you to take what I would do and make it your own unless it actually fits for you, because what you need to do is dig deep within yourself and go, does this fit for me? If what Rick has shared with me fits for me, then great. But make sure it truly aligns with you, because within ourselves is where the true answers lie. And I think as a society, we've become too accustomed to, well, let me go ask somebody. And then before we know it, all we're doing is getting other people's opinions. And then we come back to that space that you already kind of talked about. Am I being really honest within myself? And when we can be fully honest within ourselves, to me, that's when the true essence of starting to live your life out of a closet and living it fully and making bold moves truly happen. So best of luck with everything. And again, the book is Jerusalem Ablaze. We'll have links to it on the show page here, as well as links over to Orlando's website. And let me know when the next books are out. We'll probably have you back.
Great, Rick. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, absolutely. And with that, I think we're going to call it a wrap for this episode of Life Unforfeited.
And that's it. That's a wrap. Another episode of Life Uncloseted has come to an end. But don't worry, we'll be back in just a couple of days with another episode with new guests, new tips, new tricks, new wisdom about how you can go live your life uncloseted. And you know what? A lot of people out there may not even know we exist. So if you feel so compelled, share us. Tell people about it. Give us a rating and review on iTunes. Share it from your phone. Wherever you can, spread the word. Because the more people that we reach, the better the planet will be when everybody is living their life uncloseted. I'm Rick Clemens, the host of the show, that big, bold move expert, and that guy that constantly wants to help people step out, step up, and step into living their life uncloseted. Have a great couple of days, everyone, and we will be right back with you very, very soon. Take care.